This podcast is kindly supported by Resolute Investment Managers, Inc. and 91 Asset Management. Resolute Investment Managers, Inc. is a diversified multi-affiliate asset management platform that partners at more than 30 best-in-class affiliated and independent investment managers. It offers a unique platform that delivers strategic value through the full suite of distribution, operational, and administrative services available to affiliates and partners. 91 Asset Management is a global asset manager with emerging markets roots that brings a different perspective to active and sustainable investing.
We started in 2006. 2008 was the beginning of the Great Recession, right? It was when the world fell apart. And I've always said that was a blessing and a curse, because two women came out of a large financial institution. And there was always the question hanging over our head, was it them? Did you guys really do it? Or was it the bank? And I think that 2008 allowed us to prove that it's us. We manage that portfolio and we manage the business. So I think that you take the good with the bad, right, when it comes at you, because it helps you show something, prove something, or develop something along the way.
I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Kelly Chesney, who is principal and co-founder of Plutus Management, an alternatives manager based in the Chicago area. The firm, founded in 2006, has two female founders. She has a long history in investment management, particularly in the area of hedge funds, investing, and consulting, and started her career as an attorney. Welcome, Kelly. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Ethan, for having me.
Can we start with your background and career journey? Where did you grow up? What did you study? And how did you end up in the investing arena?
Well, I like to say I have a bit of a checkered past, in that I have kind of moved around, and really it was all kind of pursuit of a passion, something that I was really passionate about doing. I grew up in the Chicago area, although originally I'm from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a very small town. But I grew up in Chicago. I did all of my schooling here. And that includes my undergraduate degree, my law degree, and my MBA. And I think for me, each one of those and the corresponding jobs that I've had along the way built skills that I could take with me, and then gave me the skills that I needed to be part of founding Plutus.
And talk a little bit about that. So maybe the origins of when you knew the moment was right, whether it was the first time you thought of this, or whether it had been the culmination of many years of wondering whether you could, in preparation, and what made you finally take the leap?
Yeah. So the couple of things. Connie is the entrepreneur of the two of us. I was perfectly happy doing kind of what we enjoyed doing and what we were good at in the confines of a large institution. But, you know, with mergers come changes. And it was interesting because we did 5 months of them, kind of the JP Morgan folks trying to figure out who we were, what we did, and how we did it. And at the end of that process, they offered us each different roles at the bank. But we had learned over that time that we approached things very differently. We grew up as investors of bank capital before we started taking client money. And really, there's a huge difference between being an investor and an asset allocator. And I think that is one of the things we came to appreciate. So never in my wildest dreams did I expect to be the co-owner of a small business. But when, you know, I follow my passions, and I believed that after this process that we really had something special. And so that's when we decided, rather than being bankers for the rest of our lives, we decided to continue doing what we loved doing and what we did well. And we took the leap. I felt more pushed, but we took the leap to found Plutus.
And just before we go on, what is the difference between being an investor and an asset allocator? You said you were investors. What did that mean in terms of your ownership of ideas, your taking of risk?
I think that it kind of flips things on their head in some ways. It is understanding, first of all, what the opportunities are. And then I think the second thing is understanding the risks involved. Many people pick allocations, you know, based, all right, what kind of returns and things we're going to get, but really understanding the risks that are involved. And then understanding the best way to go about capturing that. And the bank had direct investing desks that we were part of. Connie was on the investment committee. I was the attorney. So we had seen and essentially helped build internal hedge funds. So going out and investing in managers, we first looked at, are they doing something special, something different? Do they really have a talent? And then looked at the firm and the risks related to the firm and layered those. And for us, it is very much an active management. So if convertible ARB is out of favor, we may lower the allocation. And as you know, I have mentioned previously, when we see an opportunity that we think is a great investment opportunity, we will find the manager. The managers don't necessarily drive what we invest in. It's the opportunities.
Really interesting. And then just going back, so we share the fact that we both studied law and practice law, and also we have spent time in consulting. Any skills from those arenas that you brought into your investing career?
Absolutely. I'll be honest, there's skills from every aspect, right, that you learn to bring along. I think that for me in particular, so before I was at the bank, I was in large law firms and I practiced bankruptcy and workout law. At the bank, the entire capital markets group were my clients, right? I talked to and worked with the foreign exchange and derivatives traders. I was involved in developing the first credit default swap that the bank did. So all of those things definitely played. And of course, understanding securities laws helped me be able to be part of the investment committee and to understand what we were investing in. And I'm still a lawyer, right? So if I'm Yang, Connie's Yang, I'm the conservative one. She's the much more outgoing and optimistic one on that. It's a good role and a good balance. So I think that those skills and consulting, you go in and you evaluate, right? You evaluate a business or a function. You learn to dig down and you have to communicate. As a consultant, you have to be able to communicate with your clients. So all of those skills really helped.
And it's fascinating because, of course, Connie was a guest on this podcast and we spoke a little bit about your journey as entrepreneurs and we chuckled about some of the biases you encountered as a twin female entrepreneurial team. Given you were not the entrepreneurial one, as you say, how would you kind of look back at the time of founding the firm? And maybe can you just remind us when it was founded, how many years ago, to give the context?
Yeah, it was founded in 2006. So we're on 17 years, 18 years this year together on our own. And I say that we're just stubborn and we keep going. You know, it was interesting. I mentor young aspiring managers. And it's funny now because the advice that I give them in terms of trying to figure out how to set up a fund and what to do and what to look for, I never had. We had some opportunities to work with other folks that really never went through. So in the end, it was her and I looking at each other and saying, we can do this and we will make this work. And it started out from subletting some office space to our first clients were folks that knew we left the bank and they contacted us, but we didn't start with much. And it was very much a, if we build it, they will come mentality, but it was thrilling and it was exciting because we took what we thought was wrong with the structure of a large financial institution, you know, that they can only offer one flavor of things. And every customer is the same to them. Whereas we have learned and seen, especially with alternatives, right? You have to understand where that fits in a client's portfolio and what other risks that they're taking. And so we wanted to be able to customize and really be client focused. And that was it was really exciting. And we felt really good about what we were doing.
Well, 17 years is a remarkably long period in the context of the fast-moving world of alternatives. So naturally, there will have been evolution and adaptation by you, by your clients within that period. I'd like to just bring it forward to today, Apousios. What would be at the forefront of your mind as you execute this role today? What are you focused on within the umbrella of alternatives? And where do you see the opportunity?
Well, I think that right now, we're seeing a lot of opportunity. I mean, alternatives, we believe, always have a place in a portfolio, right? But like everything else, they're going to have their times when they're in favor and they're not. So zero interest rate, loose monetary policy, low volatility, low dispersion, those are not going to be good environments for hedge fund alternatives investing. And, you know, that's what we had from the end of the Great Recession to 2020. Thank you, COVID. Hello, volatility, right? But we have always been active and adjusted. So for us, it was, you know, really kind of communicating with clients and having them understand what we were doing and where we were adding value. Maybe our portfolio wasn't high returning, but it did still provide some downside protection. It did provide access to other opportunities. The good news is right now is a great opportunity for alternatives from long short equity, arbitrage strategies, event driven and credit strategies. There's a lot of opportunities that alternative investments can take advantage of that traditional managers can't. I think that for us, you know, we started in 2006, 2008 was the beginning of the Great Recession, right? It was when the world fell apart. And I've always said that was a blessing and a curse. Because two women came out of a large financial institution. And there was always the question hanging over our head, was it them? Did you guys really do it? Or was it the bank? And I think that 2008 allowed us to prove that it's us. We manage that portfolio and we manage the business. So I think that you take the good with the bad, right, when it comes at you, because it helps you show something, prove something, or develop something along the way. Right now, both of us have pretty extensive credit experience from the bank times, and we've watched the private credit market grow. And now it has become kind of the flavor of the day. But it's offered, it's funny, because it's only really offered in two flavors. It's like these private equity-like long-term structures and these more liquid structures. And they all seem pretty vanilla to us. And so for us, in speaking to some potential clients, and it gets to something that I know you're interested in, an RIA who wanted to offer private credit to their clients, we did develop a product that is an accredited investor product, private credit, in order to bring a diversified, more liquid product to investors. I think that one of the things that we've learned and you know along the way is that, and then as a manager, it'd be great. Managers really want to lock your money up for as long as they possibly can. They like the comfort of knowing that and understanding that. And I can appreciate that, but we want the ability to move our money around and do what we need with it. And so being able to provide a product that is more liquid, but still provides that exposure, I think was great. And now we're in the process of developing a more institutional version of the product and using managers that we've known for a long time. Actually, this will actually have 50% or more diverse managers in it across strategies and will be actively managed. You know, the credit cycle changes, right? There's different opportunities through the cycle. So we believe in managing through that and working with that. So I think that we're seeing lots of opportunities right now. We're seeing a lot of folks without experience kind of jumping on the bandwagon. And we're really excited about our flagship portfolio. We have an event-driven portfolio and also about the private credit. And for us, that's the thrill, is building these things, right? We're builders. And having these portfolios and seeing how they play out and managing them along the way is really what gets us up in the morning.
It's really interesting that you mention that tailoring and the liquidity needs. And because my impression, I've been in hedge funds since 2002, been covering hedge funds since then, is that the liquidity features are getting better for some of the private wealth or retail-oriented clients with smaller bite sizes, in terms of that they're more fit for purpose. They're not trying to match a liquidity that doesn't match an underlying, perhaps. So we've kind of moved on from that kind of wave of mis-selling. Similarly, mm-hmm. we've got better brand names in there. And I also think, I certainly see from my perspective in an RIA, the perspective of tailoring and customization being absolutely front and center as the order of the day. So mm-hmm. I suppose when you say that you've always customized, how have you done that? And how have you achieved scale at the same time? That's a bit of a tension sometimes between customization and scale.
Yeah, well, I think part of it is you have to have a legal structure that allows it. Otherwise, it's not cost effective for clients if they can't come into your main structure. And so we have offshore as a segregated portfolio company, onshore as a series LLC. So we can do different classes that do customize, and we have done them all along. Achieving scale, that's a different matter. It has to be worth it, obviously, even just to open a class and manage that and deal with the administrator. But we have found along the way that there's a lot of times when folks will ask for that customization, but then as they get into it and understand what you do, their needs and what they look for really become clear and much more simplified. I say we have an event-driven, that's really just a class in our fund. That's just our catalyst managers. So we've made it easier from a structural perspective to do it. And then building portfolios is what we do. And so we're happy to do it. Does it take a lot of time? Sometimes, yes. I will tell you the most false starts we've had, or it's never a waste of time, is when folks are like, all right, we want diversity. And there's a lot of folks that talk the talk on diversity. And we're like, all right, we have this robust database of diverse managers. We use them in our portfolios as we can, and they're in almost all of our portfolios. There's a certain percentage of them. But if you want diverse, we can give you 100% diverse. We can give you 100% diverse that's hedge and traditional. How do you want them? Do you want bigger managers above 250? You know, we can slice and dice them. We have the tools to do that. It's whether the walk part is really there. And that's really hard to watch, because you get to the point where it's like, we could do this. This would be a great fund. And, you know, as you have managers, one of the reasons we have multi-manager products is because not every strategy is in favor at every time, right? And not every strategy can get every opportunity. And I think that it's better for managers, especially smaller managers, diverse managers, to be in a portfolio, because then the other strategies are performing when you're not, and you're not under this like spotlight that comes up on every investor committee meeting. They're not doing well. They're not doing well. Well, they're not doing well because they're not really supposed to do that well right now. But these other folks are. So that has been a passion for us. Diversity has been a great passion for us, as you know, from the start. And we talk the talk, walk the walk, and we're willing to build it for you. But they haven't come so far. If they build it, you will come.
That's such an interesting segue. And I think we're asking this question, having this discussion at a very interesting time, just when certain institutions are pulling back explicitly from that, only having made small inroads into not even getting to walk the walk. They've just talked the talk, and now they're not even talking the talk anymore. So mm-hmm. I think that's another kind of backdrop factor. It's a good segue to my question around diversity, though, because how do you thread that needle? Because on the one hand, you want to be selected based on merit. And on the other hand, there are clearly mandates going for diverse managers, but they seem to have a lot of hair on them or be slightly complex because they, A, may be getting this pushback today, but B, may not be getting the sort of size of the allocation that they should be because mm-hmm. they're seen as being peripheral or fringe. So I suppose how, yeah, maybe.
There's not two hands.
Yeah.
There's not two hands. Mm-hmm. There really is only one hand. I mean, we don't ever want an allocation because we're women. We want it because what we do well, and we can provide a solution for a client that is great for them. But raising assets is not easy. It's not easy for a small manager. As you say, you get the size, they can't be more than 10%, they can't do that. But it's also been more difficult for women. And part of that is because of biases that aren't necessarily overt biases, but there are more men in the allocator seats, and people like to do things with people that are familiar to them, that are similar to them. There are fewer diverse funds around, so they might have to look a little bit harder. And I think that that's hard for a lot of investors to do, especially when you're relying on consultants who can only manage a certain universe of managers. So I think that it is interesting because there is that pushback now. But from our perspective, it was never because we were diverse. And we don't ever put a diverse manager in the portfolio because they're diverse. We just want to give them, it's like the Rooney Rule, they get the opportunity for the spot. And we find that diverse managers, women managers, they process risk taking everything differently. Diversity, your background, it forms how you think about things and how you approach things. And we think that those managers, actually, they're our secret sauce. Because when we build a portfolio for you, it's not going to be all the big guys. Because especially in the alternative space, then you're buying an index, but you're paying for an alternative. And so we look for managers, and the smaller managers, they look in niche areas and they do smaller deals. Well, they could be great deals, but it's not worth it for a big institution to even look at that deal. So we believe it's a differentiator. It diversifies our portfolio. Yeah, we have some big managers in there, but they do what we've hired them to do from when they were small, and we've grown with them. I think part of it is it's very difficult in some ways to understand alternatives. It's a huge umbrella, and there are so many different risks, right? It's easy when you invest in an equity to understand that there could be a stock market crash, right? That's known. That's kind of understood. But understanding exactly what alternatives managers do is harder. And you really need to have someone who trusts you or someone who can get in and understand what they're investing in.
We're going to take a short break from the program to chat with one of the sponsors of this podcast, Resolute Investment Managers. I sat down with Jay Schilling, Vice President. Jay, can you describe your client base and how that's evolving?
So the main client base is retail financial intermediaries. So that's comprised roughly a third each between RIAs, wirehouses, and independent broker dealers. And then secondary for us is the institutional space. So historically, that's primarily been defined contribution and defined benefit. And then our affiliates, we do have a handful of kind of top tier endowments across some of those affiliates. So that is the space that we are actively targeting, is those financial intermediaries. And the products are now allowing for that, right? Like, so retail SMAs, CITs, and ETFs, as we've kind of proved out in this space, whether that's a passive ETF or an active ETF, that is the biggest thing. And then second to that, and probably still as most important though, is education. And, you know, the world has changed from a hybrid situation, but the education is still paramount to be able to keep clients invested and to be able to educate up clients on exciting and innovative areas that are continuing to push forward into products. So education is absolutely critical to stay in front. And that's all the way down to the end client, to the end shareholders.
And now back to the show.
So yeah. Let's move on to some reflections now. So we've talked a little bit about some of the challenges in raising a fund and the decision tree around starting it. Were there any particular setbacks or challenges throughout the course of your career or investment mistakes that you learned lessons from? Since there's an excellent article in the Harvard Business Review by Amy Edmondson about the hardest thing about failure is learning from it.
Oh, that's perfect. Actually, that's perfect. Because, well, in terms of, let's do setbacks and challenges. Okay, we started in 2006 and 2008 hit. So, you know, we did have a baptism by fire. But I think that if it's your passion, you can persevere. And we have proven that. In terms of making mistakes, I mean, what we look for when a manager makes an investment mistake is the nature of that mistake. And if they learn from it, what have they learned? And can they adapt, if they need to, their processes? And I think that that has served us well over time. I think that, you know, there was a time when long short managers lost their way. Shorting really wasn't doing much. It couldn't. When you had the AMC and the meme stocks and all of that, that changed things. And so what you do is you go in and you look, all right, the circumstances have changed. Can you adjust your processes? And the managers we fired over the years have been the managers that say, no, our processes are fine. This is a fad. It'll be okay. The managers that we stick with are the ones that do evolve and do learn from their mistakes. Now, if there's just really bad judgment, then that's another story. And we really haven't, luckily, we've kind of avoided those over the years.
I love that because obviously we also, as investors, focus on style drift. And we need to know the difference between rigid style, that process that can't change, and then drift, which gets away from the core competency, which is also a kind of almost a severe adaptation or an extreme adaptation. But it's always kind of towing the line there. We've spoken a little bit about all these podcasts about mentorship and key people. And I wonder whether in your career, there were any key people who had a particular influence on you. I'm presuming Connie is one of them, but anyone you can share who maybe influenced how you see the world?
Yes. I mean, there's a lot, right? I mean, you can't go through this much life and not be affected by people. You are one. But I'm going to go with, I once worked for a partner at a law firm, and he loved what he did so much. He was excited to come into work today, and he didn't care about doing the most mundane, courteous things because he just was passionate about what he did and he loved it. And now I'm at a law firm, right? So I'm not young at this point. That was the first time in my life I had this aha moment that you could actually love what you do and be passionate about it. And I think that that's really, well, that's actually when I left the law firm after I discovered that and went to work for the bank and have been pursuing it up until, you know, and I found it. I found it when you mix legal structures and law and complicated things with interesting and complicated investment strategies. So I think that's another person that to this day stands out to me.
I had one of those, also a partner at a law firm, and it's so inspiring. It really is. And I thank you for sharing that. Thinking about these legends in our careers, were there any pieces of advice or words of wisdom that they shared with you or any creed or motto that you internalized?
Well, I'm pretty simple. I think that the best information I got was also when I was at a law firm. It was a very large, very intense law firm. And one of the senior lawyers there, after we'd been up for like 36 hours or whatever, and I was just, he said, don't make a decision when you're tired, angry, or overwhelmed. Just let it go, get back to normal, and then make the decision. And I think that is the best advice. And I live by it till this day.
Well, that's wonderful, Kelly. And I'm going to take away from our conversation that if you're passionate, you can persevere. Because I think that is definitely a key differentiator, finding that passion, finding the sticking power that comes from the passion. Thank you so much for coming here. You are the yin to the yang of Connie Tesca. And we featured Connie many years ago on this podcast. It sounds like many, probably about 2 years ago. And it's now great to kind of complete that picture of Plusios and what you've built and what you stand for. So thank you for coming and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Paces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.